Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, today, I'm operating solo, but please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts. I am also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. I truly appreciate it, and this is another way that we can all make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, our guest today, Scott Stabile, is the author of the new book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, which reads like an operating manual for living a heart-centered life in the good times and the bad. Now, Scott has amassed a sizable Facebook following with his inspirational and provocative quotes, essays, and live videos. His previous works include Just Love, Iris, and the Little Pet Hospital series. A regular contributor to the Huffington Post, Scott runs day-long empowerment workshops nationally and internationally. Now, his early journey to get to this place in his life is not one that you would expect, and certainly not one anyone would wish for. Scott, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here, Alan.
Now, Scott, I've had a chance to read the book, and I just absolutely love it. It is so empowering. It really, I think, makes all of us really look a lot at sharing, how important that is. And you begin the book by sharing some deeply personal and tragic things that occurred early in your life. And as I read the book, I began to understand why and how important it is for all of us to not bottle these things up inside. So if you would, please share some of these things and why you felt it was important to your growth and your search for big love.
Sure. Well, I mean, the biggest event in my life was losing my parents when I was 14. They were shot to death in their market in Detroit. And obviously that was a profoundly difficult and traumatic experience, and one which uprooted everything about my life. And so and then 9 years after that, my brother, who had been addicted to heroin his entire adult life, died. He OD'd on heroin. So again, another really, really tragic event in our family. That one was less so than my parents in that it was, less shocking. My brother was in a rough way for many, many, many years. So I think my siblings and I all expected to receive that call someday that the heroin would eventually take him, which didn't make it less sad necessarily, just less shocking. With my parents, though, it was a complete and utter shock and devastation. And, you talk about what I've shared in the book and what I've chosen to share. And that wasn't the case for me initially. When I was, I lost them at 14, which was very young. And all I did to handle the grief at that time was bottle it away. And it wasn't even a conscious choice on my part. I think subconsciously divine intervention, I don't know, but some part of me knew that I wasn't going to be able to process the depth of sadness and rage that I felt about losing my parents and losing them so violently. And once a year I would have a really good cry, but mostly I kept it a secret. It was my biggest secret. I didn't tell, I moved to a new school. I didn't tell anybody about my parents. I manipulated conversations that were steering toward family to some other subject, so no one would ever ask me about my family. And I created this big, big secret about it. And listen, here's the thing, though I don't, so the chapter that I, when I speak about my parents for the first time in the chapter called Dig, the whole point of that chapter is to encourage people to face their pain honestly and look at it and be willing to experience it and not put up walls to it. Though I'm incredibly grateful as a teenager that I did just the opposite. I think that it really served me at that time. But ultimately what I found in my early 20s when I started to do a bit more reading in the world of self-help and personal development and spirituality, I started to recognize that these walls I had put up to my darkness were also walls I was putting up to light. And by not facing my pain honestly and allowing for grieving, I was also inhibiting the deepest possible connections, not just with myself, but with others in my life. And so at that point, I recognized I need to face this differently. You know, I don't think there are rules about how we deal with grief. I think people deal with grief however they're able to deal with grief. And I know that for me, that it was only when I really started to allow for the tears and the sadness and the rage and all that anger and energy to clear out of my body did I feel like I was more present in my life and more available to the people in my life. And it, I also felt like that grief no longer had the control on me that it had for so many years when I was trying to keep it a secret.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most profound things that I got right from the beginning, which is that so many of us, if we're having problems in other relationships, that we have chosen to, by bottling these other things up, we've chosen to not really open up to them. They never really see the true us. And I think it helps us to look at things a little differently and to look at it to go, well, by not opening up to them, how am I appearing to them? I'm appearing closed off. If I'm appearing closed off, are they then going to hold back love because they don't think that I have it to share either? And I thought that was very profound, and it's one of the first things that I got from the book.
Yeah, thank you. There's no telling how much we are preventing ourselves from experiencing by not dealing honestly with what's going on inside of us. I mean, it manifests physically, it manifests emotionally, because all of that stuff that we're avoiding facing or feeling and dealing with, it's not leaving us just because we're avoiding it or just because we're choosing to numb ourselves away from it. It's still in our body. It's still in our minds. It's still in our being. So, and it absolutely is affecting our relationships. You know?
Now, do you believe that your brother's way of masking that was the drugs that he chose to take?
You know, my brother was 18 years older than I was, so as far as anyone could make out, he started using heroin around the time he was 18, which made me an infant, you know, or just born. So I only knew him through the lens of his addiction. And he was a very kind-hearted, beautiful man, but most of his life was spent away from the family because when he was actively using, he wasn't often coming around. And when he was, it was often a very uncomfortable, you know, situation to deal with. So I think my sense of him is that, and my sense of many people who are addicted to who are in hardcore addiction to whatever they're addicted to, also recognizing, I think we live in an incredibly addicted society. And if you're not consciously addicted to something, most of us are riding the line to some sort of addiction because we're all numbing and escaping feeling, uncomfortable feelings. But with my brother, I think he was really sensitive, you know, and I think that this world as it was too much for him. And I don't know everything that played into that. I don't know what all of his internal struggles were, or even any of them. But I feel like, as with many of people addicted to substances, they just can't deal with this reality. They're too sensitive for all the insanity and craziness that exists on this planet.
Now, we have an email question. I think it's a question and a comment coming in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time that send these in either ahead of the show or during the show. This one, I think, goes right into this part that we're talking about right now. This one reads, "Our big brother held our family together after our parents were killed in an auto accident when we were young teenagers. In his mid-30s now, he seems to be falling apart. And I feel it may be because both my sister and I are now through college, married, and no longer need him as our guardian. He lost his job recently, and we think he may be taking other substances in addition to alcohol, which he adamantly denies. We want to be there for him, but every approach we have taken to get him to open up and let us in has failed. We plan to give him your book. Do you have any other suggestions as to what we can do to help him?" And this is from Jill in Riverside.
Did you say from Jill or Joe?
Jill, female.
Jill, okay, yeah. It's a beautiful question. And look, my experience in this world with other people in our lives is that the most we can do is show up. The most we can do is make it clear that we are there for them in their time of need. And even if, what I've learned, I mean, by living with a brother who was, addicted, and having lots of friends who've been dealing with addiction, and even beyond addiction, there's depression. There's so many things where people can be very hard to reach when they're in the throes of whatever it is they're dealing with. I think that one thing to understand, Jill, is that you cannot own any of your brother's choices, that whatever he chooses to do for himself and for his life, ultimately it's beyond your power, but you can continue to show up in every way imaginable. You know, you can, if you live near him, you can stop by, you can be calling him, you can just be making yourself present and in your presence, even if you're not saying anything, even if there is no right thing to say, because there's so often no right thing to say when someone's really struggling, or no thing that is ultimately going to help that person move beyond whatever they're going through. But just by being there and just by loving, I don't know what more you could be doing for him.
I think it makes great sense. And I like the fact that you're focusing on just being there, because I think, unfortunately, in many cases, for those of us that try to be there and we try to help, and it's part of our sort of helper bee mentality, sometimes, as much as we may think that we are doing everything we can to help, looking at it from the other side, sometimes the other person will see it as judging and then not accept it in the positive light that it's meant. So, again, I think you bring a great point of just being able to tell somebody, "I'm here and I'm listening." And so then without commenting, they then don't see it as judging. So I think that's
exactly
very wise.
And it opens up so often that is what creates a space for that person to potentially share what's really going on for them. Because so often if we're coming at people, and sometimes people, they're wanting your advice, they're asking for it, they're asking for your opinions, and that's all beautiful. Give it by all means. But sometimes people are really just looking for your presence, and that creates space for them to offer, their internal dialogue if they so choose.
Yeah, and I think you say it very well in your book. You say, nothing stands to transform us, our relationships, and the world more than a commitment to live our lives from love. And so by just being there and saying, "I love you and I'm here to listen," I think that again, it says it very well right in the book. So tell us a little bit more about that concept.
Well, I'm a big fan. of love. Basically, you know, that's the essence of what I talk and write about. As I see love, you know, that's the energy that lives beneath all of the noise and busyness of our minds in this world. You know, when we're centered in ourselves, and when we're in that quiet space, for me, that's love. And kindness is love in action. Compassion is love in action. Forgiveness is love in action. Like, we're being offered all through the day opportunities to exercise love in different ways with different people and always with ourselves. So in my experience in life, I'm 46 now, I have found nothing that even comes close to creating more positive, powerful change in my life than operating from a place of love as often as I can. And that is in no way to suggest that I'm always there, you know, or always operating from that place at all, you know, but I'm really dedicated to being as loving as I can be as often as possible. And I'm dedicated to bringing my awareness to those moments when I'm not being loving, and as best as I can do, shift myself back to love and own the times when I'm being a jerk and being impatient and being blameful, you know, as much as I can. But we're also all human, you know, and we're all jerks and crazy and blameful sometimes. And that's part of this experience too. But there's so much to learn from everything we feel, but it's the moments when I'm like centered in my love and sharing that energy with people and with the world and with myself that I feel most transformed. And that's what I'm saying.
And that's another beautiful thing about the book, and that I got from it is it's saying that we can all be love spreaders. You know, that we don't have to be taken in by the negativity that's put out, you know, in the media, or that's put out, you know, through with the political agenda or anything else. We don't have to breathe that in. We can all be love spreaders. And I like the fact that you really kind of go through some of the things of what you can do on a daily basis. It not only helps you, but it helps those around you. So again, I got to tell you, that's one of the things that I get from the book and really appreciate it.
Cool. Thank you so much.
And I think for everybody else out there, I mean, you've also built this social media presence. And again, for those that don't know, I believe you have, I think it's over 350,000 followers on Facebook. So that's another outlet where, you know, there are memes, there are things that people can go to take in some of, not only take in some of the love, but take some of that information and spread it out further, you know, and you've made it very simple for us.
Yeah. Well, look, there are tools everywhere, you know, when I talk about everyone being love spreaders, it's just the acknowledgement that if you are entering into your community, you're going to the grocery store and you're being kind to the clerk who's checking you out and sharing a moment of connection, you know, that is spreading love. You know, if you're in the bathroom looking at yourself in the mirror and criticizing everything about your appearance, and then taking a moment to recognize that that's all conditioned nonsense, and you take even 2 seconds to look in the mirror and say, you are beautiful just as you are, that's spreading love. Like, we're given moments constantly to spread love. And social media, because so many of us are on social media, and I'm on social media in an unhealthy way right now in my life. I admit that is an addiction for me. But I do have, you know, on Facebook especially, my social media is curated in a way that it's a lot of positive messaging coming through my feed instead of a lot of the negative that you see out there. And we can choose, you know, a lot of people, what I found on my Facebook page when I started it about 5 years ago, is that when I really started to share myself beyond just the happy stuff that I was sharing initially, and I still share a lot of happy stuff, when I started to share the fears and the insecurities and more of my life story, that the page really started to shift. The energy of the page and the responses from people were more like, me too, and thank you so much, and you're not alone. And it was such a reminder to me how similar we all are, mm-hmm. and how connected we all can be when we share ourselves honestly, and when we're not so committed to just putting a perfect picture of our lives out there, because that isn't real. But when we're committed to sharing the full story, we create a space for others to feel more empowered to share their full story, and also to feel a lot less alone in their struggle. And that was a big hope with Big Love, with the book. It's just one of the big hopes is that people are going to feel less alone in their struggles, because we're all struggling. You know, we're all doing whatever we can do to make sense of this often crazy and also beautiful reality.
Well, you've now led me to say something that I never thought I would ever say. On this show, we talk about addiction in such a negative thing. If I'm going to have an addiction, I want yours. So I want to be addicted to love. I want to be addicted to being I'm going to be addicted to being a love spreader. So anybody
Hallelujah.
Out there, if you have that addictive personality and you've gone, okay, well, you know, it used to be cigarettes and then it was alcohol. And guess what? You have something you can shift it to. We can all shift it to, and we'll all be going in the right direction.
Absolutely, brother. Preach.
Yes. So now you talk a little bit about writing as a tool, and obviously you're doing a lot of writing now because you're writing books, you know, you're all over the internet and stuff. Talk a little bit about how your writing has helped you to process, or you've used it as a tool to be able to process some of the pain away.
In a couple ways, honestly. One, it's just getting the energy out of your body again. I think that when we're holding on to, writing for me as a tool comes in great handy when I'm dealing with sadness and when I'm dealing with anger, I found for myself. Because you're holding on to those emotions inside of you, and you can feel them in your body. I mean, we all know what it feels like to feel rage in our body. And for me, being able to kind of vomit my feelings out in that moment, especially because if I'm feeling rage, you know, at someone in my life or because of an event that happened in my life, I've learned that it's typically not best to approach the person when you're in the state of rage. That doesn't usually lead to any sort of healing moment. So in those moments, I like to write it out and just kind of get it out. But also what happens what I found with writing is that when you start playing with your thoughts and your ideas and your feelings, and you start putting them down on the page, you end up uncovering things about yourself. It becomes kind of an exploration, and you might be delving into one area of your sadness, and you'll see that it leads to this other thing that you hadn't necessarily attached to that specific, you know, part of what you were feeling. And I think that it doesn't always happen. I don't always sit down and it's this grand exploration. You know, sometimes it's just a barrage of, you know, rage, but sometimes it's really this beautiful uncovering of more to the story that I don't think I would have gotten had I not taken the time to sit down with my journal or at my computer and explore it through writing.
Now, how much of that exploration leads you to forgiveness?
Well, I'm committed to forgiveness.
I was going to say, be it yourself or others. I think sometimes we have to forgive ourselves, and sometimes as we're going this exploration, you know, it can be someone else.
I don't know that it's the exploration that leads me to forgiveness. Typically what I found in my life is that it's empathy supported by compassion that leads me to forgiveness. And, you know, the example I'll use, because it's been my most profound example of forgiveness, was forgiving the man who murdered my parents. And that, again, I was 14. That wasn't anything I was even thinking about when I would think about him. But as I started to get older, and I'm in my early to mid-20s, and I'm recognizing that, you know, these feelings of hatred and and blame when I would think of him. They're not serving me in any way that's positive. And it was at that same time that I started to consider the man who murdered my parents as another human being, and tried to imagine what his life experience could possibly have been like to get him to that point. And I don't pretend to know exactly what his life experience was, but what I did imagine is that nobody who is operating from any sense of self-worth or self-love could ever, you know, walk into a market and shoot people. It just doesn't happen. And I thought, well, I can't imagine killing someone, but I can certainly connect to feeling unloved and unworthy and unseen. And I can connect to being so angry that I wish people would die. Like, I could connect to all of these things that all of us as human beings can understand at moments in our lives. And when I realized that, I saw this is just another human being who's no less worthy of love than I am. He's no less worthy of forgiveness than I am. He made a horrible choice and did a horrible thing. And he's a human being. And once I started to see him in that light, it was like forgiveness found me. You know, it wasn't this pronouncement of I forgive him and it happened. It wasn't like that at all. But I noticed that when I would think about him, it was through a completely different lens. It was forgiveness, you know, and it's only because I took the time and put energy into empathizing with him.
Wow. Our guest is Scott Stabile. The book is called Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. And, you know, again, after just hearing what it is that he has gone through, stay with us, because when we come back, we're going to talk about where Scott spent 13 years in a cult. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. I'm Alan Cardoza. You're listening to Answers for the Family. And our topic today is big love. So when we went to break, I mentioned that our guest, Scott, found himself in a cult for 13 years. So what compelled you for this to be a part of your life?
It's funny.
And why did you finally decide to walk away?
Well, this was in my, you know, early to mid-20s, around 23, 24, and I was in San Francisco, and I had befriended several people who were incredible and always talking about love and peace and compassion as life goals. And I had just gotten out of a job working as a law clerk in a law firm, thinking I might want to go on to become a lawyer. And instead found myself at this New Age gift store reading all of these books about enlightenment and meeting all of these really interesting kind of peace and love people. And it felt really right. You know, that I felt like, wow, this I get, you know, this makes sense to me to choose love as your main goal in life and then see how other things play into that. And so I quickly came to find that a lot of these people had a guru. And I wanted to meet the guru, and eventually did meet the guru. And was really attracted to what I saw in him as his unconditional love. He professed himself to be an enlightened being. And at the time, enlightenment was what I wanted the most in my life. And he was surrounded by really loving, amazing people. So for me, making the choice to be, and I definitely didn't really even recognize it. I mean, it's hard to be in a community like that and go to meetings where he's at the head and everyone's kind of surrounding to him and tending to him. Of course, in your head, you're thinking this feels very cultish, but it didn't even matter to me. You know, I was so in love with everything I was experiencing there and in love with people who were being honest with themselves and each other about their darkness as well as their light, and unconditional love seemed to be the foundation behind it all. And so that's why I got involved, and that's why I stayed involved for so long. But part of the experience for me was also a struggle to accept that the leader was really as enlightened as he professed himself to be. Based on things he would say and do and the way that the entire community was really built around taking care of him in his life in every way imaginable, and that he was really the focus and that nothing he said, was ever wrong. He called himself a puppet of God, and that everything that came through him was basically God speaking through him. So no matter what he was telling us, if we were in resistance to it, we were resisting God. We were resisting our path to enlightenment. And there was really never room within that to challenge him. So, and I accepted that for a long time too, but not in an easy way. I was always fighting with myself to believe in his enlightenment and convincing myself that even though that looked pretty egomaniacal, what do I know about enlightenment? I don't know anything. So who am I to speak to his enlightenment? And then you're also surrounded by people who are, feeding into that. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of manipulation in that world. And no one could speak ill of the guru ever. And so it's a weird experience because I still have a lot of very fond memories. And it in part really connected me to my path of love, and I'll always be grateful to that. But it was also very manipulative and lots of lies and lots of distortions and lots of cruelty and not anything. I don't believe that to be committed to unconditional love, I think there are ways to do it without having to manipulate a lot of people in the process. So that's why I left in the end. I felt one that he and I had gone as far as we could possibly go as a guru and his disciple. And I also just didn't believe that, his entire path was predicated on the truth that he was enlightened, like on par with Buddha and Jesus and any other enlightened teacher you can think of. And when I really became clear that that wasn't the case, it was impossible to stay because it was a lie, So that's why I left. And when I left him, my hope was to remain friends with, you have to understand, these were the people I was with all the time. This was my family. Mm-hmm. So when I left initially, I remained friends with my friends. And we're talking about between 20 and 30 people. But ultimately, he wasn't okay with that. And he had told them to delete me from their lives. And they did overnight with no contact. I got a message from my closest friend in the group who just said, she texted me, please don't contact me ever again. And that's, that was about 8 years ago. I've never heard mm-hmm. from any of them.
Wow. Yeah, that's, a form of brainwashing that is very unfortunate. And, as an investigator, we've located and returned teenagers who have gotten involved in groups like that, and we've seen a very ugly side of it after we've retrieved them and brought them back to their family, and learn and learned how, for the most part, part of the conditioning was that they needed to be alienated from anybody that could possibly disagree with anything that they said, and demonized everybody, which included the parents. So in some cases, these kids came back with a message that their parents were demons, and you know that they could not be trusted, and so on. And it took a lot of time and a lot of therapy and a lot of opening up for some of these kids to realize that wasn't the case, that you know that their parents were operating from a position of love, which is why they wanted them found, which is why they wanted them home, and why they wanted to be with them. So but it sounds like you were able to go into a situation, gain some perspective from it, but at the same time, maintain your own center of what's right and wrong.
Yes, and I think, and I'm really grateful, because the truth is, there, you know, my experience there was that I never lost touch with the outside world. You know, I maintained friendships outside of the cult. I maintain my relationship with my family, and I wouldn't say in any way that this community was as insidious as trying to suggest that, like, your parents are demons and stuff. But there was very much a sense that if someone didn't agree with the leader, they were in their darkness, and so we were like trained to, you know, love them from afar or whatever, love them and respect them, but recognize that they're not operating from a clear place. Because if you're operating from a clear place, and I'm sure, believe me, with this book out now, I assure you I'm being condemned, but you know, that I am lost in my darkness, and this is a grand betrayal, and all of this stuff that I've watched happen over the years with others who have chosen to leave the community. You know, there's no room for acknowledgement that if you reject this master as an enlightened person, there's something wrong with you, basically. That's how it's presented.
Well, but the way in which you have done this, and with the book, and focusing on love, focusing on having an open heart to people, I think there may be people that may have been followers or whatever that would read your book and think, you know, maybe he's got something there. So, you know, which I don't think that was necessarily your intention or anything, but I think that something like that, rather than just coming out and saying, you know, all of this is bad, you're just focusing on what's good.
Yeah, I mean, look, my intention with that chapter specifically, one, was just to remind people, because especially I suspect a lot of the people who are reading my book, you know, they're seekers. You know, there are a lot of us spiritual seekers out there in trying to better ourselves and better our lives. And we tend to look for different teachers in the form of books and podcasts and people and whatever else. And this chapter is just a reminder that if something is not feeling right to you, you know, no matter, even if all of your friends are in love with this podcast, if every time you're listening to the podcast, you're not connecting, or you're connecting in a way that makes you feel really bad about your whatever it is, you can move on to something different. Like, we don't have to lock ourselves in to specific teachers, even if they've been our teachers for years. And it's suddenly starting to feel wrong. You know, when we move on from the things that ultimately don't serve us or don't feel right for us, we create space for new teachers and new experiences. And in saying that, I'm not suggesting that if anything that doesn't feel uncomfortable, we run from it, because I believe often that when we're feeling uncomfortable, that there's a trigger there, there's a provocation there, there's something to look at. You know, there's almost always something to look at in ourselves. But we can be really selective about the teachers we invite into our lives. So that was one thing I wanted to communicate in there. And I'm surprised a few people have already reached out to me. I think that, honestly, cults like this, they don't make the news. They're not as dark as Jim Jones and the Manson. It's not that. Mm-hmm. But they're doing real damage to people out there. And I feel lucky that I was more centered in who I was and in the life that I had outside of the cult. But I know people who left that cult who were in therapy for PTSD for years because of their experience in it. And I think that I've already received notes from people who've read my book and thanked me for that chapter and said that they had similar experiences in their lives. So I think that this, and even beyond just a cult like that, when we look at any of the tribes, quote unquote, our religions, whenever we're involved in a group or a methodology that doesn't ultimately resonate with who we feel we really are in our hearts, mm-hmm. it's worth, you know, summoning the courage to consider moving on from that, because then we open ourselves up to finding the things that do align with who we really are.
Yeah, I agree. And I know that in many cases, people will talk to me about going to a particular seminar or meeting with a particular group. And they'll ask my opinion. And my question to them is, who is it empowering? Is it empowering you? Mm-hmm. Then that's probably something that would be incredible. Is it only empowering them? Maybe you should look a little deeper, you know? So,
yeah, that's good advice. And getting back to bring it back to writing, one thing I'll say is that also with this chapter, I knew that I would not include anything about the cult if I couldn't do it from a loving place inside, in a clear place inside. Like I didn't in any way want to be vindictive, and I don't feel the chapter is vindictive. That wasn't my intention at all. But when you talk about how writing serves as a tool, that vindictive stuff, that all came out in my journal. I mean, the raging that went on about that experience and, you know, all of that helped me tremendously to put that in writing in my journal. But, you know, Big Love is about, you know, finding a way back to love in terms of how we communicate and show up in the world, which is what I tried to do with the chapter, but also acknowledging the things I didn't agree with. Because I don't think that to be loving, we're silent in the face of what's wrong in the world, or we're silent in the face of injustice. I think that we make noise mm-hmm. when we see injustice, but we figure out how to bring some compassion and love to that anger, you know, that's provoked by all the injustices we see in the world. And that's all I'm trying to do, is to be clear and communicative and even angry when I'm angry, but to see, like, what can love create with that energy as well.
Well, another thing that is in the book and that I want to touch on before we run out of time is the happiness challenge. So share with our listeners a little bit about that.
Sure. This was last year, February, I announced a happiness challenge on my Facebook page. And the idea was everyone choose one thing they're going to do every day that month to potentially create more happiness in their life. So I chose yoga for an hour each day. Some people chose meditation. Some people chose taking walks. Some people chose dancing. Whatever it was, people committed to doing it every day. You know, I chose February, honestly, because it's the shortest month. So it makes it easier to make it through. So for 28 days, or 29, I think it was that year, we did our thing. But what I knew, but then it confirmed it in this, because in the world of personal development, you see this meme over and over that happiness is a choice, and you're being hammered with this message, choose happiness, happiness is a choice, happiness is a choice. And the reality is happiness is an emotion, and our emotions are not choices. And so what I found myself, you know, feeling like I should be able to choose my happiness because everyone's saying that we should be able to, but that's not how feelings really work. And so on top of not being happy all the time, you also are feeling like a failure, like you're doing something wrong because you're not able to choose it. And I was connecting my level of happiness with my, you know, my spiritual enlightenment, and none of that is true. And the thing I was trying to encourage with the happiness challenge is this recognition that though we can't choose our happiness, we can absolutely choose to take action that can lead to more happiness in our lives. So think about things that make you happy. Maybe that's a walk through the woods. Like when you walk in the woods, you tend to feel happier. Okay, so make time to walk through the woods, knowing that you're not choosing happiness, you're choosing to take a walk through the woods. but there's a good chance that that's going to put a smile on your face. And these are the types of choices we can be considering every day, all through the day. I mean, that's one of the tenets of self-care, is just making choices that stand to bring more meaning and more joy into our lives. But not just recognizing what they are, actually taking the action to do them. So that's what I was trying to communicate.
Yeah, and I love it. And I also love the fact that the way that you explain it, and I'm glad that a lot of the people got to hear it, because a lot of our listeners are teachers, psychiatrists, psychologists, people that are working with at-risk youth, and many parents out there. And to be able to think about this in a different aspect, which is, we not only, are not, if we're not happy, some of us then tend to take on that guilt, like you said, in regards to, well, now I feel guilty about the fact that I should know better. You know, well, I do this for a living, so why don't I know better? Why can't I just push a button and happiness comes? So
exactly.
So I really appreciate that, and I see it. I see what you're talking about, and I also see that we have another listener question that's coming across. This one reads:
okay.
I work with a very talented and creative individual at our marketing company. Because he recently came out and let us know that he's gay, two of the other males in our department have started not including him in important meetings. He is he's very hurt, he's depressed, and he's talking about leaving, which would be a great loss to the company and personally to those of us who truly value him. I was thinking about giving him your book and sending him to your Facebook page, but first I wanted to hear from you how the book could help get him through this difficult time. And this is from Gloria in Illinois.
Well, thank you, Gloria. Look, I think that you're going to help get him through this difficult time more than my book is going to help him get through this difficult time, in that you're present with him on a day-to-day basis, and you have an opportunity to show your support for who he is, no matter who he loves and all of that. You have an opportunity to show your love. You have an opportunity to be there and be in his corner. You know, look, in terms of the book, it is also about people embracing who they are, which it sounds like he is doing finally. And he's going to find, I suspect, based on my own experience as a gay man and based on the experience of everyone I know who's gay, and that's a lot of people, is that the process of coming out is, it's so many things. And one of those things is, it's just this profound weight is lifted from your shoulders, because you're being honest with who you really are, potentially for the first time. I don't know his story. I don't know who he's come out to before this, but there's a profound freedom that comes with that. But based on how people, respond to that news, there's also a lot of negative energy coming your way. And that's not anything new for gay people, because we're used to seeing, I mean, we have our politicians arguing about our rights all the time. So you're seeing it, out there on a more global public scale, but when it's directed at you, it hurts. And the only thing I can say to that is real. It should hurt. Of course it hurts. When people are excluding you because of your sexuality, there's really no way around that pain. It's easy to say, I don't care what people think, but the truth is, I care what people think. Like, I don't care enough about what people think to change who I am, to live within their conditions, but it still hurts. You know, if someone writes to me and calls me a faggot or, criticizes me for my sexuality, it's always going to hurt. I don't know the dynamics of your work environment, and I don't know who's running the show, but before he leaves, if it's at all possible, and you and the others who support him could be a part of this too, like, go to the management, go to the people in charge, like, create an environment where he can't be excluded from these meetings. Because the other thing about, and the reason why attitudes about gay people are changing in our country and have changed so profoundly over the years, it's because more and more people are meeting gay people, more and more people are getting to know gay people because more gay people are feeling more comfortable being who they are. And it's really hard once you get to know someone and work beside someone and, you know, share a team experience with a gay person. It's much harder to hate them simply because they're gay. So I would recommend you do everything in your power to make it impossible to exclude him in your
yes.
company and support him in that way. You know?
Yeah.
And then as far as the book is also all about authenticity and speaks to all of these things, but he's going to have to go, that's part of the gay experience, sadly, is being on the receiving end of homophobia. You know, that's part of it.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more with everything that you've said. And to add to that is that this speaks more to it speaks more to the two people that feel that they need to not include him. But it also speaks wonderfully to Gloria, who is taking the time to talk about this, to show him that he is supported. And I agree with you. If they go to management or whatever and say, you know, this person isn't the problem, but maybe these other two that are not inclusive might be the problem. And rather than lose somebody who seems to be very well liked by the majority of the people in this company, maybe management needs to look at those that that maybe are more divisive. So thank you, Scott. Thank you for the time. Thank you for the book. You know, again, I think it's great. There's nothing more important out there that we can promote that other than love. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, let's hope that we all catch it.
Yeah.
And again, for everybody out there, if you want to reach Scott, or if you want to, you know, you want to get the book, you can go to scottstabile.com. Last name is spelled STABILE. You can also find him on Facebook along with the other 350,000 people. You can find him on Facebook. And so, Scott, before we go, I just want to acknowledge you for your courage in sharing some very, very personal stories, but at the same time, doing it with love. So again, thank you so much.
Alan, thank you so much. And really, truly, you are a love spreader. Thank you for this show and for what you're doing to better our world. It's making a difference, a big difference. So thanks for having me here.
You're very welcome. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put it on your calendar and join us next Monday when we're joined by Dr. Julia Sloan, author of Learning to Think Strategically. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Vimeo, or whatever area that you use to listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. Next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. And as I said, go to Scott's Facebook page. It is amazing. And again, you spell his last name, STABILE. Be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.